From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. A commentary by one scholar at the National Humanities Center that recently appeared on Soundings elicited discussion and response from other scholars at the center. The commentary was by Werner Danhauser, a professor of government on leave from Cornell University. Professor Danhauser's comments were about women, nature, and society. Soundings now repeats Professor Danhauser's commentary, which will be followed in turn by a response from other scholars at the National Humanities Center. Here's Professor Werner Danhauser.
What's happened to sex in the last 15 years? Maybe nobody knows. Privacy still shrouds the subject. So sex remains to some extent inaccessible to our lust for data. People still do it, but the details are subject to the sanctioned lies of those who do it too much or too little. All our speculations fail to transcend speculation. For when it comes to sex, each of us speaks from a small corner of experience and a vast domain of brooding. Compounding my own ignorance is the fact that I've aged about 10 years during the past 15, a fate that may skew my views. Well, what has happened to sex in the last 15 years? Women's liberation. That is the main part of the answer. The question used to be, what does woman want? And when we asked that, we were not like Freud, expressing despair at our inability to understand women. We accepted them as wondrously strange and tried to please them, to win their approval. Today, the question more often than not has become, what does the women's liberation movement want? That's hard to say, but in one momentous respect, all feminists agree. The whole movement distrusts nature. That is why it puts all its eggs into the rickety basket called socialization and does its best to deny that one can socialize with the grain or against it. But one can blame a hostile environment only so long. Sooner or later, one begins to rail against the way things are. Never mind that nature may have graced women in very special ways. The resentment of nature is the key to the women's movement. It explains its alliance with the left, which cannot be due to the way women are treated in countries calling themselves Marxist. It explains the movement's grim mood, the absence in it of humor and of gratitude for the world we inhabit. It also explains why the women's movement may begin by promoting sexual equality, but forever bends in a direction of assaulting sexuality as such. It is as forthrightly sexual beings, after all, that we are most natural. When Eros possesses us, we do not care for differences of race, of nationality, of social station. We just want to do what comes naturally. The most outstanding paradox of the last 15 years is that a movement professing to be interested in liberation has everywhere produced a new sexual constraint. Fewer women now want to argue with men. Bristling is the mode. Fewer men want to be bold with women. All vestiges of courage are now considered to be a form of despicable machismo. Can this onslaught on nature succeed? I don't know, but signs abound to the effect that nature has been wounded, that in 1983 sex isn't what it was in 1967. I hope that nature proves as resilient as she is supposed to be. I do hope she prevails, defended by both men and women who find it natural to assist nature. I hope the day will return when we can once more celebrate sexuality as gloriously as did the writer of the biblical proverb. There be three things which are too wonderful for me, yea, four which I know not: the way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent upon a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid.
You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. You've just heard a commentary by one scholar at the National Humanities Center, Werner Danhauser of Cornell University. Soundings now presents a response to Professor Danhauser's comments by way of a conversation among four other scholars at the National Humanities Center. They are Margretta De Grazia of the University of Pennsylvania, Layla Ahmed of the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, Patricia Spax of Yale University, and Martha Woodmansee of Northwestern University. Here is Margretta De Grazia.
Implicit in our discussion is a questioning of the very mode in which Professor Dannhauser has chosen to speak, the mode of the commentary, which suits his very authoritarian and patriarchal views quite well, I think. But to the extent that we are questioning those views, we are also questioning the mode in which he pronounces them. Therefore, we have preferred to present our views in the form of a discussion, as opposed to a pronouncement given in the form of commentary. I think also that Professor Dannhauser's use of so many of the terms that we would need to use in responding to him are subject to question, and that will be, I think, one of the things that we want to talk about, to answer him directly using terms we couldn't use, answer him directly using the terms that he uses, terms like nature, feminism, and sex.
When he speaks about nature being wounded, for example, I don't know whether he knows that he is echoing Paradise Lost, where nature is wounded at the point where Eve takes a bite of the apple. And I think that really is exactly what he is talking about, is that women, 20th century, late 20th century women seem to him to be recapitulating the original sin. The original sin was being uppity, after all. It was Eve trying to, succumbing to the temptation to try to know as much as the gods, and this idea that women are wounding nature, are defying the natural, are defying the order of things, is saying exactly what theologians said for several centuries. Theologians over and over again pointed out that women were the origin of sin in the world, and it sounds as though they still are.
His terms are used in such an exceedingly biased way, yet used as if they possess a kind of given and universal truth.
An authority.
Right. And so to argue with him is an exceedingly difficult matter, because it does involve disagreement at the level of basics, and a disagreement that I don't think he will admit. And if he does have difficulty engaging women in argument, I think it has a great deal to do with the type of terminology he uses. It's very difficult to gain access into it.
That's right. If you appropriate nature to be on your side, I mean, he is taking nature and sex as natural sexuality as being on his side, which leaves for women the position of being unnatural and anti-sexual unless they endorse the system that he appears to be endorsing.
So his whole mode is really that of a personal lament couched as doctrine, philosophic doctrine.
Well, I think that's a very good formulation, Lila. Personal lament couched as doctrine. The tone of lament is very, very powerful.
He seems to lump so much together under the category of nature. It's difficult for me to understand what beyond the simple fact of procreation, what about sex beyond this simple fact could be natural. It seems to me that all else is socially mediated. That is, it can be otherwise given a different kind of upbringing.
Yes, it's a peculiar position for a political scientist to take, to assume that the erotic is something that has to do with nature rather than with culture and society. I think it's a very, very difficult matter to talk about the women's movement in the way that Professor Dannhauser has talked about it. The notion of feminism is almost as complicated a notion as the notion of nature or the notion of sex, two of the other terms he very freely uses. He says at one point that all feminists agree that the whole movement distrusts nature. I can't think of very much of anything that I would say that all feminists agree about, unless it's that all feminists agree to take women seriously. I have to say that in his remarks about feminism and sex, I am reminded of the Victorian commentary on the effects of higher education for women. In Victorian magazine comments on this new phenomenon, there were many scientists who took to print to announce that if women studied too much, their breasts would atrophy, they would no longer be able to feed their children, and that they would stop being sexual beings. And this seems to me to be an argument of much the same sort. But I think one effect of the allegation in his remarks is to suggest that feminism is entirely a political movement, and it is not entirely a political movement. It's a movement which involves all aspects of life, and which insists on the notion that women should be treated as subjects rather than as objects. But one of the differences between sex now and in 1967 is certainly that women now are claiming more right to be agents as well as objects of desire, to have their own desires considered and to assert their own desires. Professor Danhauser seems to say that it's now very difficult to figure out what women want. I would say that it was now much easier to figure out what women want because they're saying what they want. I think Professor Danhauser is expressing a lot of pain and bewilderment about what it is that has happened to relations between the sexes, and I suppose that's a response partly to some genuine confusions that have been created as a result of the women's movement, some confusion about the proper roles of men and women. I think many of us would believe that confusion is really healthy and a good thing, and that it doesn't interfere with sex at all, that it only interferes with the operation of very old stereotypes.
His use of natural anyway is totally baffling, because he's implying some way of relating between the sexes that goes back into eternity and across cultures, and both of which we know is not the case, that they have differed profoundly between culture and culture and age and age.
What would be some examples of this, of these differences?
Well, perhaps before getting into specifically sexual differences in the understanding of what's natural, one could broaden it a bit and just speak of that term at large, that what is considered naturally, what is considered to be natural is usually considered to be so by whoever reigns the ideology of the day, and therefore whatever is going to be natural is going to be the condition that in some way supports his being in that ideologically prominent position. And you can take the case of women who about whom over the centuries it has been said that it is unnatural for them to do abstract thinking. The same sort of claims have been made in terms of blacks and what is natural, or whatever minority one might want to choose. It can be ethnic, it can be sexual, it can be social. In the 17th and the 18th century, it would have, one can find indications that the poor were thought to be by nature depraved. But again, that's simply a way of describing nature that is convenient to those who are in power. And for Professor Danhauser to assume that it is natural for women to have a submissive and passive relation to men is presumably what best endorses his position.
Yes, and the use of the use of the pronoun she, in fact, reflects exactly what you've been talking about, in the sense that nature has been viewed in a as female in a culture where it was thought that it was necessary to control and get nature to submit. So it isn't at all a way of seeing what he called it. It's a wondrous What did
she mean? Wondrously
yes, wondrously nature had to be tamed and brought into proper human control. It wasn't an admiration of its wondrousness that made them call it she.
So you're associating bringing women into control with the control of the natural environment.
That's right.
In the West.
And yes, and one of the things that is argued by feminists is that exactly as this planet has been devastated ecologically, so women have been devastated by men. And
so he's talking from the point of view of a very specific social, economic, and sexual class. There's so much anger expressed sub rosa in this commentary of his, and I wonder if we could imagine reversing the speakers. If this were a woman speaking, I believe that the listener would say, this woman is very frustrated.
To get back to the question of whether men can argue with women or whether they just bristle, it seems to me that the kind of situation that the commentary posits as ideal, in which a man approaches a woman in order to please her, in order to win her approval, is hardly invites the kind of parity that is necessary for reasonable and profitable argument or conversation. I'm not at all sure what kind of talking results in the kind of sexual relation that he implies, where the male is so clearly in the dominant and authoritative position. That doesn't at all sound to me as if it would be conducive for argument or conversation of any kind. And I think one of the things that has measurably, or at least noticeably, improved over the 15-year period that he's referring to is the type of conversation that is true, type of conversation that is possible between men and women, that I think has certainly clear relations to sexual relations that occur between them.
Well, is it possible that precisely this improvement in conversation could have hurt sex, at least from the point of view of the man?
I don't know. It seems to me that the way in which conversation has improved between men and women, if indeed it has, is that women are feeling freer to tell the truth now. And whether telling the truth is conducive to better sexual relations, I don't know. Maybe that's what Professor Danhauser is complaining about. I keep trying to figure out as we go along what it is exactly that he's talking about, and it doesn't get any easier. It's interesting that his view of the women's movement, in as much as I can understand it, appears to be that women's liberation and feminism generally are against various things. I mean, explicitly throughout his remarks, the feminism is opposed to nature. Implicitly throughout his remarks, feminism seems to be opposed to men as well as to sexuality. In fact, feminism is a movement which has more positive than negative aspects. It's in favor of various things, not simply opposed to various things.
It seems to me that he's talking about the fact that in the last 15 years, women have wanted a say in sexual relationships with men.
But do you think, Martha, that he wants to stop there? Or do you think implicit in this kind of a criticism of the sexual aspects of feminism is a much broader criticism that includes not only what happens in the bedroom, but what happens in the outside world as well?
Absolutely.
Because to renounce whatever equality has been conferred upon women by the feminist movement is to renounce a kind of equality in the professional world and the economic and political world as well. That's asking a lot.
Yes, I'm afraid it's too late.
Well, one thing certainly that the women's movement has taught women to want is the room to discover their own natures and to discover the possibilities for using those natures within the framework of society. There has been recent work done among feminists. I'm thinking, for example, of Carol Gilligan's book, In a Different Voice, in which she examines the hypothesis that women may have different ways of formulating moral problems and different ways of thinking morally from men's ways, and the implications of that kind of hypothesis are very far-reaching indeed. They suggest that we have lived in a world in which all the definitions of the proper ways to think and the proper ways to understand have been essentially male definitions, and that it's possible now, for the first time, to imagine a world in which those definitions of how to think and how to understand could be enlarged in terms of an entirely different system. The women's movement has enlarged the ways of thinking both about women and about men, and has suggested, this idea goes back at least as far as Virginia Woolf, has suggested that since there are male components in all females and female components in all males, that it would be nice to be able to value ourselves more fully than in the past we have been allowed to. We meaning now not just women, but meaning men and women.
This is the first time that the women's way of thinking or of doing things or of speaking, that's one of the things that women's liberation is asking for and making possible. But in fact, really what we're, I was thinking in that connection of a book called The Gnostic Gospels, in which the early church rejected a whole lot of Christian gospels as heretical. And there were the gospels in which women were preachers. So what I was thinking was that there have been times in history when women's modes has been allowed to be part of the official culture much more than in recent Western European culture, and that it's partly this enormous control that since printing that has given men, made it possible for them to turn it into such a patriarchal culture, with a control of those modes, and that what we're partly doing is regaining or bringing back a voice that has been part of it, but has, in the recent few centuries, has gone under, has been suppressed.
Certainly there is a lot of literature by women for a long time suggesting that women have felt their own natures to be severely constrained by what men have imposed upon them, and it would seem to me to make much more sense to speak of the women's movement as being in favor of nature than of it as being opposed to nature. I'm thinking, for example, of Kate Chopin's novel The Awakening, which was written in 1899, in which a conventional middle-class woman discovers increasingly that her life as the wife of a perfectly decent man is insufferably constraining. And in the final scene, she swims out to sea and commits suicide by swimming out to sea in an image which is obviously intended to associate what she is doing in trying to get away from this constraint with the natural. But the natural leads for her to death because of the fact that in the society there is no room for women to be natural.
Do you think that Professor Danhauser believes that the women's movement is actually insisting that women and men are alike?
The difference that he appears to be implying is the difference between women as specifically sexual, sexually submissive, and men as specifically sexually dominant. I'm talking about lots of other differences and about enlarging the notions of intellectual discourse, of politics, of government, of everything in order to include the women's way.
And then that should be part of not only of women's way, but of men's way. That's part of what
yes.
The women are saying.
Yes, that's obviously important, that it's not just a matter of the difference between men and women, but that once the difference on the women's side is fully valued, it should be possible to incorporate it as a dominant mode just as much as the other. In other words, again, it's a matter of enlarging our our social definitions, as opposed to restricting and narrowing them, which seems to be what Professor Danhauser is advocating.
I don't suppose that would cut very deep, though, with Professor Danhauser, who seems to have been quite happy with the more constrained, constricted modes of yesteryear.
Oh, yes, exactly. He's happy, I'm not.
So you're, in a sense, trying to convince him to be saved when he thought he already was. Convince him to adopt a new mode when, in fact, he was happy with the old mode.
Would it be possible to ask ourselves what it would take to convince someone like Professor Danhauser that his views were outmoded, mistaken, unprofitable? I think what we all reacted to when we heard his broadcast was the fact that his views seemed so utterly anachronistic, that he has been in this world for 15 years, yet wants to revert back to a time 15 years ago.
There is nothing specific in his lament, really, and there is nothing specific that he is advocating. He is saying, in effect, he used to feel better 15 years ago than he feels now, and it's our fault. And I suppose if we say that we feel better now than we did 15 years ago, that would be an utterly irrelevant response. And yet, surely the way we feel about things should have some bearing on an assessment of what has happened.
I was wondering if there's any way one can see Wern's argument as at all true. I mean, I could conceive of somebody arguing that almost across most cultures, women are in a subordinate position. Can one then conclude that it is in some sense natural that women should be subordinate?
Why couldn't one just say it's thoroughly contingent?
I have a feeling that whether one looks to history or to biology, for an example of male or female domination, one is going to find what one wants to find. It can work either way.
But also, the fact that if a thing exists in nature does not mean that it's necessarily desirable. I mean, even if we were to think that this is the case.
I think that's so true, and I must say I did bristle at Professor Danhauser's comments on Eros that sounded so much like out-and-out sexual drive. I found it most surprising to see him endorsing that kind of almost animalistic behavior, what is rather than what ought to be, as if we should give in to those desires, assuming that we have them.
Yes, to assume that the erotic is the most natural aspect of humanity seems rather peculiar.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to a discussion about women, nature, and society with four scholars at the National Humanities Center. The panelists were Margrethe de Grazia of the University of Pennsylvania, Leila Ahmed of the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, Patricia Spax of Yale University, and Martha Woodmansee of Northwestern University. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.